Good evening. Who killed Jeffrey Epstein as the suicide theory is debunked? Jane Doe 15 is revealed. Why Ukraine? Experts weigh in on Trump as a war criminal. And Sweden drops rape charges against Julian Assange. What's next? With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienza with the WBAI News for Tuesday, November 19, 2019. Prosecutors charged two correctional officers with ignoring their duties and sleeping on the job when they should have been keeping high-profile accused pedophile Jeffrey Epstein under watch. The guards were only 15 feet away from Epstein's cell the night he died. Epstein was found dead on August 10th. The Metropolitan Corrections Center, where Epstein was housed, has suffered from short staffing and budget cuts that have plagued Bureau of Prisons facilities around the country. Attorney General William Barr previously said investigators found irregularities at the MCC, which has housed notorious terrorists and drug kingpins. Meanwhile, under questioning by GOP Senator Lindsey Graham, the Bureau of Prisons chief, Kathleen Hawke Sawyer, told the Judiciary Committee that the FBI and a Department of Justice watchdog were investigating Epstein's death.
In my opening statement, I wanted to talk about the death of Mr. Epstein. Do you concur with the opinion that it was a suicide?
That was the finding of the coroner, sir.
Okay. Do you have any evidence to suggest otherwise?
I do not.
How could this have happened?
Unfortunately, sir, the death and the whole situation is still under the investigation of the FBI and the Inspector General's office, and I'm really not at liberty to discuss specifics of this case. I can discuss issues around institutional operations, but I can't specifically talk about that particular issue.
Okay. With a case this high profile, there's got to be either major malfunction of the system or a criminal enterprise at foot to allow this to happen. So are you looking at both? Is the FBI looking at both?
If the FBI is involved, then they are looking at criminal enterprise, yes.
Do we have people in custody today of this high-profile nature? Have we done anything to adjust since Mr. Epstein's death?
Sir, we take every inmate's life very seriously in the Bureau of Prisons. A high-profile inmate is no more important or significant in terms of our operations than just the average inmate that comes our way.
What do you mean high-profile? Somebody's on a suicide watch.
I would like to explain our suicide watch system, if I may. I can't talk specifically about Epstein, but we have different tiers of response if we identify an inmate who appears to be having suicidal thinking. And I came into the Bureau as a psychologist. I worked with lots of suicidal inmates. I was warden in our psychiatric facility in Butner, and I know how difficult it is to always be able to predict who is suicidal and who is not. But once an inmate is identified as potentially suicidal, we have a suicide watch operation that we can place them in. It's a very stark, very difficult setting where everything is stripped from the room except a mattress. They get a coarse gown like to wear that cannot be twisted in any way that they could hang themselves from it. They have one mattress and one blanket, and they are watched constantly. There's nothing else in that room.
Was Mr. Epstein on suicide watch?
Yes, he was. However, the average time on suicide watch is only about 24 hours because it is such a stark and actually depressing situation. We then can move them to another tier of observation, which is called psychological observation.
Did that happen in this case?
I can't speak specifically, but I am sharing this with you so that you understand our procedure, sir. They then can move to another tier, which is psychological observation, where they get their clothes back. They're in a more normalized setting. They are watched and scrutinized every moment of the day, but that is a much more normal environment.
Do they have roommates?
I'm sorry, sir?
Do they have roommates?
No, they do not when they're on psychological observation because they're being watched continuously.
Did Mr. Epstein have a roommate when he allegedly committed suicide?
No, he did not.
Okay. Go ahead.
They move into psychological observation. Psychologists see them routinely, interview them repeatedly, and once it's determined that the threat of suicide seems to have passed, then that inmate can be returned back to open population.
Well, clearly it didn't work here, so we await the report because all the victims of Mr. Epstein have to have their heart ripped out.
And that's a Bureau of Prisons Director Kathleen Hawke Sawyer being interviewed by Senator Lindsey Graham. Earlier this week in Los Angeles, a woman named Jane Doe 15 appeared alongside lawyer Gloria Allred at a press conference. She's suing Jeffrey Epstein's estate, claiming the sex offender took her sexual innocence.
Jeffrey Epstein started his targeted grooming and manipulation of me as a child when I was in New York City for a school trip. I first came into contact with an assistant of Epstein's while on a high school drama club field trip to New York City. I was invited to his home. There, his assistant took a photo of me and then later reached out to me, inviting me to Epstein's ranch. I only knew Jeffrey Epstein for 5 days during a trip to Zorro Ranch, his massive compound surrounded by government land in the New Mexico desert. Epstein took my sexual innocence in front of a wall of framed photographs of him shaking hands and smiling with celebrities and political leaders. I was only 15 years old. After, he wanted to talk with me about what had just been my first sexual experience and directed me to take time to myself that night to cry. He said that would be beneficial to my growth. After this, we had a long talk about my future goals. I told him that I wanted to go to college to study biochemistry. He said that he wanted to give me money for college. He asked me how much money I thought he should give me. At 15 years old, living in northern Michigan with my mother, stepfather, and grandfather, I had no idea how to respond to a billionaire who had just raped me.
Jane Doe, 15, speaking earlier this week. Federal prosecutors also said Tuesday that Epstein was alone in his cell the night he allegedly hung himself with a bedsheet. But forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Bodden revealed Epstein's body bore telltale signs of homicide, despite the official ruling that he had killed himself. Bodden, a former New York City medical examiner, attended the autopsy for the Epstein family. He says he's not convinced Epstein killed himself in an exclusive interview with WBAI.
At the time of the autopsy, the medical examiner doing the autopsy did not say suicide. The death certificate said pending further studies, that more information was needed. And I agreed with that, that more information was needed, that the autopsy findings alone does not establish a suicide.
Hey, you're the expert. Tell us what we need to know about that if we're not experts at this.
Depending on how the hanging, usually in most hangings, there is compression of the neck and carotid arteries at each side of the neck, and the person dies without any fractures in the bones of the neck, the hyoid bone and the larynx, the thyroid cartilage in particular. But in a small percentage, then one can get a fracture, a hyoid bone or a thyroid cartilage, which is unusual to begin with in a hanging. In this instance, there were three fractures, two in the thyroid cartilage, the Adam's apple, and one in the hyoid bone, which gave me the opinion that the possibility of a homicidal ligature strangulation had to be investigated, more information obtained.
The FBI says they are investigating.
The FBI results, and they had new results come out today, largely has to do with the security issues. Hopefully, they're also investigating the cause of death, but I haven't heard anything other than they accepted the cause of death by the medical examiner in New York City as eventually as a hanging suicide.
You've done a lot of criminal cases, sir. Looking at this, do you think this was done by a professional or by a raging person or by accident?
I can't tell that. I think that the findings of the neck injuries and the ligature finding are more suggestive of strangulation than of suicidal hanging, but that has to be investigated further, and more information has to be released that hasn't been released yet about how he was found, where was the ligature, what kind of ligature was it when it was found, and how was his body positioned when it was found. That hasn't been released yet.
A ligature is what was used to choke him.
A ligature, it would be something that's used to compress the neck. Yes, a rope or a belt or even a torn sheet could be. And the ligature in this, if it was a suicide, was a torn sheet. But that has to be further looked into.
Okay, very good. The more I learn, the more mysterious it gets. Let me last question. In your long career doing this kind of work, is this an unusual case, or have you seen this before?
Yeah, yes, it is an unusual case, because normally the injuries aren't that severe in the neck from a suicide, and normally the body is viewed while still in the at the scene of death. There's an issue here why the body was removed, and that interferes with a full forensic examination.
Is prison a dangerous place to be if people have a price on your head?
Yes.
I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much. Anything you'd like to add?
No, just good to talk to you, and I've been a long-term BAI fan. So
cool. Thank you. Appreciate that. We're back on. All right. Thank you very much.
Forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Bodden speaking exclusively with WBAI. And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored, locally produced, and independent WBAI in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Swedish authorities have discontinued an investigation into a rape allegation against the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange after a review of the evidence. The deputy chief prosecutor, Eva Marie Persson, said the complainant's evidence was deemed credible and reliable, but that after nearly a decade, witnesses' memories have faded. Assange, who is battling extradition to the U.S., which accuses him of publishing secret documents related to his WikiLeaks work, has been facing potential charges in Sweden since 2010. The 48-year-old has denied all allegations against him. Swedish prosecutors dropped their preliminary investigation into the rape allegation in 2017 because they were unable to proceed while Assange remained in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. But the investigation was reopened in May this year after Assange was removed from the embassy when the Latin American government abruptly withdrew his asylum. Tuesday's decision was welcomed by WikiLeaks, which called for a focus on the threat of extradition to the U.S. Nathan Fuller is director of the Courage Foundation. He says Assange's persecution by the Trump administration is a threat to journalists worldwide.
Today, Sweden dropped its preliminary investigation of Julian Assange for the third time in a press conference earlier today. So Assange remains in prison in London. And the UK authorities are only holding him now on the U.S. extradition request.
I thought he was being held for bail jumping as well.
He was until about a month ago, and the bail sentence ended, and Assange had a hearing in which the judge informed him that she will be keeping him in detention anyway. So the bail sentence ended, and he is now being held solely on the U.S.'s request.
So what happens next?
So Assange is scheduled for his extradition hearing in late February of 2020, and that will happen at Westminster Magistrates Court in London. It will happen over 5 days, and the UK has to decide basically whether to extradite him to the U.S. And part of that is whether the U.S.'s extradition request for the prosecution that it wants is a political one in nature. And I think all the evidence shows that it clearly is.
What are the rules for extradition in England?
So they can't extradite him if it's what's called a political offense. And they also compare if the same charge would be tried in the UK. But Assange's lawyers are going to be talking about how this is an obviously political persecution and prosecution, because no new evidence has been revealed. It's simply a matter of the Donald Trump administration is carrying forth a prosecution that the Obama administration declined to.
Well, what's the name of that prison, that notorious English prison? Is he still being held there?
Yes, he's in solitary confinement in Belmarsh Prison. It's the maximum security in what some people have called the Guantanamo of Britain. It's just outside of London, and his conditions there have been abusively restrictive.
Why is he being held in solitary confinement? Was he a problem prisoner?
No, he initially has had some health issues, and the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Melsner, has reported after visiting Assange with two doctors and conducting medical visits that Assange has suffered psychological torture. For 7 years, he was in the arbitrary detention in the embassy, but then being held in London and has endured psychological torture, basically the way that these governments have conspired together and against him, in addition to his physical prison conditions, have really led to a deterioration in his health.
How's he feeling right now?
We're not even sure if he knows this news today. I think that he doesn't actually yet, because the prison canceled today's visits, but he'll hear about it tomorrow and the next day, and I think he'll be relieved to hear that this has finally been dropped. But obviously what he has feared all along and what we've been talking about and warning about remains, which is the U.S. Extremely aggressive prosecution.
Why are they treating him as a prisoner when he's being held? He should be innocent until proven guilty, right, even in England?
Part of this is they wouldn't say this aloud, but they want to make it hard for him to prepare for his own defense. I mean, they have taken a long time to allow him to even be handed legal documents. His case involving the 2010 publications of the Iraq war logs, Afghanistan war diaries, and Cablegate, the State Department cables, is obviously a hugely complex case, tons of documents, and has been carried out over 9 years now. And so that requires extensive documents and meetings with lawyers and a computer as well. And so they basically are making it difficult for him to participate in that legal defense, which is a human right that he should be afforded.
So did Julian work together with the Putin government and other enemies of the Clinton White House or potential Clinton White House to help Donald Trump get elected?
No, but that has been a very useful narrative for opponents of WikiLeaks to use against him and to try to claim that, for example, he's never posted or published any documents about Russia, although he has, and several other major news outlets from the New York Times on down have said if they got these documents from the DNC, they're obviously newsworthy. It's very clear anyone would publish them. It's clearly a journalistic duty to do so.
Anything you'd like to add? And have you been watching the hearings? How does this play? And what do you think of the hearings? Have you been watching them at all?
I'm not following them as closely, although I've had an eye on the Roger Stone trial especially. But if I could just add, I want people to realize that to take a look at the indictment against Julian Assange, the superseding indictment with 17 counts of espionage, one count of computer crime, and realize that these are all about the publication in 2010 of these documents that made major news around the world and which hundreds and hundreds of other news outlets published as well, and realize that this is a really grave threat to the First Amendment, to our ability to publish and know what's going on behind the scenes and to be able to report about our government. This is a really grave threat.
Nathan Fuller is director of the Courage Foundation. The impeachment hearings against President Donald Trump began again today. Here's a roundup of the testimony.
I'm Jesse Lent with WBAI's Impeachment Watch. Today was day three of public impeachment hearings by the House Investigative Committee, and there were four witnesses called. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council, special advisor on Europe and Russia for Vice President Mike Pence, Jennifer Williams, former Trump administration envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, and top Russia and Europe advisor on the National Security Council, Timothy Morrison. It was Williams and Colonel Vindman who testified first. After today, it will be extremely difficult, if not impossible, for Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee to make the argument they returned to numerous times in last week's hearings that none of the witnesses Democrats are calling as part of the impeachment proceedings had any firsthand knowledge of the July 25th phone call between President Donald Trump and President Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine at the center of this impeachment hearing after President Trump asked the Ukrainian president to, quote, do us a favor and look into former Vice President Joe Biden's son and his work for the energy company Burisma. Every one of the witnesses called on Tuesday, with the exception of Volker, was listening in on the July 25th call. Here's what Colonel Vindman said his reaction was in real time.
Frankly, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was probably an element of shock that maybe in certain regards my worst fear of how our Ukraine policy could play out was playing out, and how this was likely to have significant implications for U.S. national security.
On a day that was heavy on confrontation, but produced little new information, one of the big stories was what Colonel Vindman did next, which was to speak to an unnamed intelligence official. When questioning from the ranking Republican on the committee, Congressman Devin Nunes veered into the direction of exactly which official that was. He was quickly shut down by the committee chair, Congressman Adam Schiff.
As you know, the intelligence community has 17 different agencies. What agency was this individual from?
If I could interject here, we don't want to use these proceedings.
It's our time,
I know,
Mr. Chair.
But we need to protect the whistleblower.
Please stop.
I want to make sure that there's no effort to out the whistleblower through the use of these proceedings. If the witness has a good faith belief that this may reveal the identity of the whistleblower, that is not the purpose that we are here for, and I want to advise the witness accordingly.
While the second witness, Special Advisor on Europe and Russia for Vice President Mike Pence, Jennifer Williams, did not discuss the call in such stark terms, she also explained her reasons for flagging it as problematic.
Prior to July 25th, I had participated in roughly a dozen other presidential phone calls. During my closed-door deposition, members of the committee asked about my personal views and whether I had any concerns about the July 25th call. As I testified then, I found the July 25th phone call unusual because, in contrast to other presidential calls I had observed, it involved discussion of what appeared to be a domestic political matter.
With nine witnesses being called before the committee this week, the dense schedule is reportedly due to the Democratic leadership's desire to wrap up the portion of the public impeachment hearings being conducted in the House Intelligence Committee before Thanksgiving so they can move the investigation over to the House Judiciary Committee. One side effect, however, is that at the time we're recording this at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard, two of the four witnesses called today are still currently testifying. Though, as predicted, considering Republicans in the House asked to call Volcker and Morrison, their testimony has been more supportive of the president so far. Former Trump administration envoy to Ukraine, Kirk Volcker, did seek to distance himself from the whole incident, saying he, quote, cringes when he hears himself referred to as one of the so-called three amigos overseeing President Trump's policy in Ukraine. For the WBAI Evening News, this has been Impeachment Watch. I'm Jesse Lent.
Thanks, Jesse. And Francis Boyle, a professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law, Champaign, says while Trump can be impeached for pressuring Ukraine, it's the least of the reasons the president should be removed.
Trump has committed war crimes before. It just seems that the Democrats have a fundamental disagreement with Trump on his policies towards Ukraine and Russia, and so they've decided to concentrate so far exclusively on that issue. Maybe the commentary put out today will encourage them to expand their horizons. I really don't know what to say, but certainly war crimes are far more serious than what is being considered today in the impeachment hearings.
What are some of Trump's war crimes?
Certainly what happened recently, the pardoning of U.S. military personnel who had been convicted of war crimes. In the case of two of them, murder of people who were not targets of attack or anything like that. Those are grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. Under the new U.S. Army Field Manual just put out in August of 2019, where a commander, and President Trump is commander-in-chief of U.S. Armed Forces, fails to punish or overlooks the punishment of subordinates who are guilty of war crimes, he acquiesces in those war crimes and becomes an accessory. In the case of the third U.S. military personnel, he was found guilty of desecration of corpse, which is also listed as a war crime. Likewise, President Trump has repeatedly stated now that the reason we are going to remain in Syria is to take their oil. Well, he said that repeatedly just this week. Looting is another war crime that you can find in the U.S. Army field manuals and also in the Hague regulations. His so-called attacks on Syria with cruise missiles over unfounded allegations of chemical weapons is another example. But you note, even in the U.S. news media, the reaction by former U.S. military personnel to his pardoning these war crimes has been quite severe, because it sends a terrible message to members of our military that anything can go, because Trump has your back, as it were. And to that extent, also creates disorder in the ranks. I mean, one of the reasons you have the laws of war is you don't want military personnel to be committing war crimes. You want them to be fighting battles and not going off on excursions of their own to vent their spleens or commit vengeance.
But carrying out his activities with the government of Ukraine.
I don't believe those were war crimes. What happened there, not to justify what President Trump did, I would categorize that as an abuse of power and certainly an impeachable offense, but it's not the same thing as a war crime, no. The weapons in return for an investigation into Joe Biden, that would not qualify as a war crime, but yes, it would be an impeachable offense.
Anything you like to add?
I would hope that the listeners here, and especially WBAI out there in New York, would contact Congressman Nadler. He will eventually get the whatever reports are here from Schiff and the other congressional committees, and encourage Congressman Nadler to expand the scope of their inquiry into impeachable offenses beyond just Ukraine. There's a whole variety of these. The Trump unconstitutionally taking funds that have been appropriated by Congress for other purposes to build his wall. That's a very serious blow to the United States Constitution. So I would encourage everyone there to speak with Congressman Nadler and expand the scope here beyond what Congressman Schiff is looking into. And I'd be happy to speak with Congressman Nadler and his legal staff if they want to contact me. We can run through some of these things. I think there are far more serious issues at stake here than just Ukraine. I mean, you have him separating children there at the border. That clearly would be a crime against humanity. There's a variety of issues that I really think the House Judiciary Committee should look into, since the Intelligence Committee has simply limited itself to Ukraine. But the Judiciary Committee has authority to look into all these issues before they actually bring a bill of impeachment.
Francis Boyle is professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law at Champaign. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, November 19th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Jesse Lent. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From the studios of listener-sponsored, locally produced, and independent news, I'm Paul DiRienzo.
Tuesday, November 19th at 10 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl continues the celebration of the late Harold Mayburn by presenting tenor saxophonist, composer, and instructor Eric Alexander. Join us as we discuss Eric Alexander's upcoming release, Eric Alexander with Strings, and much more.
Anyone who has been around Harold just casually or has played with him or knows him even to the slightest degree is aware of, first and foremost, what a great human being he was. I always start with that. I